Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it. Hello, my name is Paul Gleason, and my guest today is Dr. Michael F. Myers. Dr. Myers is a professor of clinical psychiatry and recent past vice chair of education and director of training in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He's the author of 9 books, including most recently a memoir, Becoming a Doctor's Doctor. Dr. Myers, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today we are going to talk a bit about LGBTQ issues. And I wanted to begin by asking you what you think some of the most pressing issues are in this area today.
Okay. Well, I think there are a number of them. And when we break down the acronym of LGBTQ, it's important to do that. In fact, just as you asked me the question, Paul, I was reminded of a session that we held at the American Psychiatric Association, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was called Whatever Happened to the B in LGBTQ? And that was the bisexual piece. I think they felt that, you know, that really needed, you know, some examination and some updating. So I think that there continue to be issues that I certainly read about in lesbian women, gay men, bisexual men and women, transgender, gender dysphoric individuals, as well as the Q that was added in the last decade, referring to either questioning individuals or the term queer.
Now, what should psychiatrists, be looking for? What issues might people in either one of these categories or all of them be bringing up in practice?
Well, one of the things, despite the fact that this is the year 2020, anecdotally, you continue to hear, though, the occasional situation where somebody is asked binary type questions, you know, are you gay or straight? Or there's an assumption made about the individual's sexual orientation, for instance, without really using language that's more inclusive, in that will then enable the individual sitting opposite you to disclose, if they're ready, their sexual orientation. So, for instance, instead of saying, now this is before we had legalized gay marriage, before that, when people would say, well, are you married or single? That was always a bit of a quandary for somebody who wasn't really ready to disclose their sexual orientation. But when you ask a general question that, are you on your own or are you in a committed relationship with anyone, anything like that, that really makes it, you know, easier. And then, of course, there's more technical type language where people really just ask questions right out in almost a checklist fashion, you know, that we see on applications for things. And so, but even that can be somewhat intimidating for individuals who are maybe not fully comfortable with their, what I would call, probably their trajectory of being out. Because as you probably know, that's a process. It's not an event. So an individual, you know, sort of may be out to their family, but not out to to their friends, or the other way around. Or they may be out to largely many of their friends and family, but they're not out publicly, or they're not out at work, especially if they're in a type of work where there still seems to be outdated ideas about sexual orientation.
So. Right. That brought up two questions to me. One, as you mentioned, this is a field that's evolving very fast. As you said, you know, the mm-hmm. Q may have just been added a few years ago, you know, and psychiatrists are already so busy, but where do you think psychiatrists can go, or what can they do to keep up with recent developments so that they can treat people who come in with respect and, you know, not rub them the wrong way.
Yeah. Paul, that's such an important question because there's so many opportunities for continuing medical education. However people do that, as you know, now we're living in a virtual world since the pandemic began. But even with that, there are so many offerings that are out there that, you know, that really cross the desk or the computer of anyone who is, you know, kind of plugged in to the various groups. And I'm not talking about ones that are specifically studying, you know, subspecialized in that form of research, because they're out there as well. But just even so many of the general things, I'll just mention that I'm on the scientific program committee of the American Psychiatric Association. I have been now for a number of years as a consultant. And we grade abstracts, and just today I was grading, I think, over 20 posters that have been submitted for the APA virtual meeting next May. Now, those are just the posters. 3 months ago, when I reviewed other submissions, which are sessions, I probably graded 75. So in terms of continuing education, there's a lot out there, and many of them are geared, you know, for the general practicing psychiatrist. And then there's ones of those, for instance, psychiatrists who are working in the areas of child and adolescent psychiatry. This subject is very important because, as you just mentioned, this field is changing so rapidly, and we're reading more and more about children, you know, identifying themselves as non-binary at a very early age and are describing, you know, feelings of the, you know, of not the sex that they were born into, or behaviors and actions and things like that. And I think where our work comes in as mental health professionals is helping, in that case, the parents understand this, come to terms with it, or whether or not, you know, to, and try to be able to answer their questions, especially the questions about, is this possibly just a phase, or is this something possibly more constitutional? And, you know, unless somebody's got sort of a bank of information and experience or access to consultants who are subspecialized in that area, they're not going to be really very helpful. So it is imperative that we keep abreast of so many of the things that are evolving so quickly.
Yeah, you know, thinking about, especially with, you know, in pediatric psychiatry, bringing in parents, I know that you yourself have done a fair amount of couples therapy and things like that. What would be, but if you could speak to the kind of family psychiatry aspect of this, you know, what might psychiatrists have to do to help the children and the patients, or the patients, who are the patients here, the children and their parents kind of understand the trajectory of what's going on?
Yes. Now, if your question, because, you know, this can be involved in the family in many ways, this could, of course, be, you know, when it's the child, quote-unquote, child who's identified patient. And I don't have direct clinical experience with that because my work has largely been adult psychiatry. But as you mentioned, Paul, I've done so much, years, or actually decades, of couples work. And when and if this has been a concern that parents have had, then I make sure that I support them in having either a psychologist or a psychiatrist in the child and adolescent field, you know, who can help them with that. But as you know, it can go the other direction as well. When one or the other of the parents is coming to terms or coming out as gay or lesbian, and then the impact of that, you know, for the children. Or if one of the parents is coming out as gender identity transition. And then, you know, my work then, of course, involves, you know, both them as a couple, but also them as a family to really help them, come to terms with this major, major transition, that is occurring in that nuclear family, and then the extended family as well.
Yes, and that brings us back to the way that these kind of coming out processes are not happening immediately, but rather their trajectories. What do clinicians need to know about supporting and caring from their patients at different phases of that of their trajectory?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure if I can be completely concrete or specific about that, because I think you put your finger on it right there when you mentioned various phases of this and where the individual may be at, and then how that then resonates or doesn't resonate, with the other relationships, whether it's the couple, or whether it's got to do with how the children might be reacting to this as well. The other thing too that I speak about a lot with my residents is when and if. Now I'm talking much more specifically now about an adult individual who describes having gender dysphoria or concerns about their gender identity, whether or not they might be trans or not. One thing that we always have to do as psychiatrists, because we're trained so extensively, is to really sort that out, because there are indeed some individuals that when they're pre-psychotic, for instance, when there's so many things that are unraveling in their life, in their thinking and in their mood and in their behavior, that this could be possibly another symptom, and that it's something that has to be taken into consideration with the full picture of this individual's mental health at the moment. And that's when we get into, the more technical aspects of taking a very detailed mental status examination and a very specific history and duration of these types of feelings and beliefs that the person is having about himself or herself at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that because these issues are so difficult and because these patients' journeys are truly trajectories, that it seems like it kind of takes a while. It seems indispensable to have a sort of solid relationship built over time with a patient to sort of see what's truly going on.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, the other thing I might add, Paul, is that it's generally felt, and I think that this is borne out by some studies, that when and if we as clinicians are not exactly sure what a term means that our patient has used, there's no harm in just admitting our ignorance at that point. They say, I'm sorry, you just used a term that I'm not familiar with. Could you explain what you mean by that? Like, for instance, if the person says, well, I'm cisgender, and the clinician is thinking, yes, I read that somewhere, but, I'm not sure if I know what that is. But just to kind of put that out there, I think, unless the clinician is doing it constantly with regard to so many things, then of course, the patient may feel that, I think I really need to go somewhere else where somebody's at least got some knowledge, of what I'm experiencing. But most will be very courteous, and will also appreciate, the effort of the clinician to get the pronoun correct, as opposed to individuals who are constantly forgetting and referring, to the individual as a he when he's a she, or the other way around, or things like that, which, I find that, most individuals, have a little bit of a sense of humor, but that can get tested when and if it appears that the clinician or other individuals are not really making a sincere effort to use the correct language.
Yeah. It seems that, in those situations, the psychiatrist is in almost in the position of me, the journalist, who has to ask questions, who doesn't really know the answers yet.
Yes.
But switching gears a little bit, we've talked about sort of where the field is now, but I wanted to rewind a bit. How have psychiatrists' ideas about the LGBTQ individuals and community. How have those ideas evolved over time?
Oh, tremendously, I would say. Paul, I trained in psychiatry. Well, actually, I graduated in medicine in 1966. I started my training, because I did other things, but I started my training in psychiatry in 1969, completed in 1973. And, for instance, back in those days, we had DSM-2. If I remember correctly, homosexuality was... it was many things. It was either a sexual deviation or a sexual perversion or a sociopathic personality disorder. It wasn't pretty. And one of the things that I mentioned in my memoir, and I won't belabor this, was that I myself was struggling with same-sex feelings in that era. And when I realized, studying psychiatry, that this is, you know, I've got a pretty awful diagnosis here. I was really quite categorically bisexual, but was expressing same-sex feelings and behaviors at the time. So I wrote in my memoir that I jumped back into a closet and slammed the door shut of a closet that I never fully left, because also I knew no one who was a gay physician, and I was just a young physician myself, and that was a very lonely, frightening feeling. And I was bisexual enough, and it was just fortuitous that a few months later, I met my girlfriend, and she became my wife, and we were together for 40 years before I ended up, you know, coming out way down the road, and I talk about that as well in the memoir. But that's just my way of saying we've come so far now with gay marriage, for instance, and long before that, you know, we had gay partnerships and civil unions and things like that. So that's made it, I think it's made it obviously healthier for individuals, but I think it's made it just so much better for the practicing clinician as well, to be able to less often deal with what used to be called egodystonic homosexuality in their patients who just hated themselves for having those same-sex feelings. I mean, we still see it, of course, especially in religious orthodoxy of most of the major religions and also some of our cultural minorities too, where they have a lot of difficulty with the subject of sexual orientation.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it. I mean, I can just imagine learning about that in medical school when you're sort of trying to become acclimatized into the profession and really thinking, you know, these are the proper diagnoses, these are the sort of scientific diagnoses of things, and then to find it turned back on yourself that way. In your experience, did that happen to a lot of people?
What was that, Paul?
Oh, I'm sorry. Were there a lot of people who, you know, read and maybe still read diagnoses and feel ashamed or feel like they want to deny the things that they're feeling because it's been kind of diagnosed as a problem?
Yeah, and also this is where, again, getting back to what we can do as clinicians, and I often tell this to our younger medical students, our residents, our early career psychiatrists who have come of age in such a socially progressive era. And so sexual orientation for them is really a no-brainer. I mean, they don't have internalized homophobia. Many of them have gay friends. They've got bi friends. They've got gender identity friends. I mean, all that sort of stuff. But what I have to kind of remind them of, though, is that they are going to have patients or patients' family members who are struggling, you know, with much more conservative, you know, ideas that are not congruent with theirs, and you have to have empathy, you have to understand, you know, their big picture, you know, where they've come from and that sort of thing in order to be able to really help them, you know, do the work that they need to do. So it's just kind of the reverse, I think, of what it was, you know, such a long time ago.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It seems like the poles have shifted or switched and stood on its head. Are there other ways you can think of that sort of the field and society's evolving ideas about LGBTQ issues have changed psychiatric practice?
Yes. The other thing, too, I think that I think we must never forget is that we just read constantly, and this isn't just in the LGBTQ scientific literature, about the high degree of trauma that young individuals today are struggling with. Again, I'm referring back largely to minorities who come in, who are kicked out of their homes, who end up on the street, and are get involved in sex trafficking sometimes, or certainly, you know, prostitution, things like that, you know, to make a living, to try to exist, and how those individuals are both at risk for non-suicidal self-injury as well as suicidal behavior and actions, and sometimes death by suicide. And of course, intravenous drug use, and then being at risk of HIV/AIDS, and just so many things like that. Because those young people, though, will say that it means so much to them to be in an environment that finally feels safe to them, or that they're just accepted and validated as fellow human beings. I mean, it's pretty granular, basically what they're asking. So.
Yeah, you mentioned intravenous drug use and HIV/AIDS, and I know from looking at your memoirs that you have quite a lot about the HIV/AIDS crisis, and I wondered if you would speak to that a little bit about your work during that period and how it may have changed how psychiatry understands issues of homosexuality or LGBTQ issues.
Yeah, I will. I was living and working in Vancouver at the time, Vancouver, Canada. And Vancouver at that time was sort of there was a particular setting that was sort of the epicenter of HIV/AIDS patients, like there were in many of the larger cities. Like here in New York City, it was St. Vincent's Hospital in Bellevue, and we had St. Paul's Hospital. And I was asked to, because of my work in physician health, if I would put together a support group for all of the frontline clinicians right in those very early days who were looking after these seriously ill young men. They were mostly men, occasional female at that time. And I said yes, and that's what we did. We met for 7 years, actually, and it was a mix of those doctors who were on the front lines, because it was a multi-system disease. So many of them were primary care physicians, but there were also, of course, internists, dermatologists, endocrinologists, psychiatrists, gastroenterologists. And my goal, and the goal was to really to try to keep them as healthy as possible, because the work they were doing was so heroic, and there were so few physicians who were willing to do the work. Like at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, we didn't really know much about contagion. It took a long time for these studies to really know how HIV was transmitted. And these were individuals who were really just doing the work that really had to be done, that sort of thing. And so I wrote about that and just how gratifying it was to really be of some help to those individuals. And then my own practice, of course, I was looking after HIV-positive medical students and physicians, some of whom then did go on to develop what used to be called full-blown AIDS and died of the illness of AIDS before it became, you know, a chronic illness as it is today. And the other facet of that I wrote about in the book, too, was also the good fortune I had to work with Dr. Peter, who became sort of an iconic Canadian physician who decided to go public when he had, when he at first knew his sister's pneumonia, but then when he became blind from CMV retinitis, he decided to go public and did what was called the CBC AIDS Diaries. And Peter had been a medical student of mine, and he and I worked together for a couple of years. We did a couple of videotapes that I was able to use in teaching. And also, because he wasn't able to work and do conventional clinical practice, he would give a lot of lectures, and I would what I would do is I would interview him. And of all of the years I was teaching, I never saw medical students or young doctors so captivated by his words, by his dignity, by his courage. And he really was an amazing individual who did so much to really bring this disease, in a sense, out of the closet and reduce the shame that so many individuals were struggling with at that time. And there's the Dr. Peter Center in Vancouver, which is not only a phenomenal foundation, but also is a day setting for what's called comfort care for individuals with AIDS. So I wanted his legacy to be, you know, to be part of, part of my book as well, Paul.
So. Yeah, you used the word courage a few times, and it seems to me that that's exactly what people needed in the early days of that crisis, because there was so much unknown. There was so much, there's not just cultural fear and stigma, but real medical uncertainty, wondering, mm-hmm. What are the risks? Am I at risk? How? And it must have taken very courageous people to say, I'm going to go in there without knowing how this is happening.
That's right. And there were so many people, too, in those days who were terrified to get an HIV/AIDS test because they just, at one level, didn't want to know. And what I found that so many patients were doing were just so, I'm just assuming I'm HIV positive, and I'm either, practicing safer sex, or I'm just celibate. That's what they decided to do. And then it was interesting that not all of them, were HIV positive, that they eventually decided to get tested and then were in shock that they actually, were not HIV positive. So, it was, it was more than a decade, I guess 15 years or so, when there was so much of that.
Yeah. So now we've talked a bit about how things are today and talked a bit about how things were at various points in the past. I'm wondering a bit about the future. You mentioned that you were reviewing submissions to the APA. How do you think that the field's understanding of LGBTQ issues might change in the future?
Yeah, it will change because, Paul, when I'm referring back to something that you said earlier for the second time, that this is just evolving so rapidly. And, I remember thinking how my own ideas of gender identity are so outdated from the way I was trained. I remember back years ago when I'd see an individual who it was, more of that classic sense, I'm a female trapped in a male body. Yes, you still hear that, but not quite as graphically as that. And those were individuals who were very clear that they needed to proceed with sex reassignment surgery, et cetera, et cetera, and that whole process. But now you see so many variations sort of along the way in this, the so-called cisgender and being non-binary and all of that sort of thing. And I know the language can be very confusing. I think it's confusing for everyone, but yet it does mean something, though, that this is transitional. And it behooves us as clinicians, irrespective of our professional career stage, to keep abreast. And as I said, there are so many opportunities, for CME. And at the end of the day, though, it's the same thing. When or if you feel that, this is just not my area, then, of course, the ethical and proper and professional thing to do is to make sure that patient of yours or whatever gets a proper referral to somebody with that expertise. So I think with all of that going on, and again, especially in gender identity, that seems to be the part of the LGBTQ acronym that is you know, and I was thinking the vast majority of the abstracts were in that dimension of LGBTQ. And also the dimension of minorities as well.
And you mentioned it a little bit, but do you see how might clinical practice be changing based on the kind of newest research that's coming out from the APA?
Well, that's a good point, too, because, see, some of this also depends on reimbursement. In fact, I'm no expert in this, Paul, but I can remember, though, a time when our language needed to be carefully crafted, in a sense, because if you're saying, again, as a, you know, I'm no expert in this, but basically if something is not a disorder, then will it be covered under insurance or programs that will offer both, you know, sort of, you know, hormonal treatment as well as surgical treatment when if this isn't a diagnosis? And yet on the other hand, do you want to be labeling what could be, you know, or is like a normal variant? You know, it was the same way, you know, earlier when, you know, homosexuality was a disease. So again, I think that's just another example of how these transitions and the evolving field of humanity is, yeah, and how that affects, you know, so much of our thinking and our research and, you know, all of the fine people who work in those areas and for instance, who, you know, who are on, you know, the DSM review committees and update and things like that, who, you know, because it's a huge number of American psychiatrists and other mental health professionals who do the heavy, you know, the heavy work there.
Right. And so finally then, you know, we've talked a bit about, you know, what psychiatrists can do to keep abreast of these issues. If they are interested in things more like advocacy, do you know where they might go to get involved?
Well, yeah, I may not be able to answer your question specifically, Paul, about that I'm not dodging it, what I do want to say, though, is that I believe strongly, and I have felt this since I was a medical student, that we have to be advocates for our patients in our respective fields, and I especially felt it once I began my psychiatry training, and I've done that all my career, you know, that I've just always been someone who felt that, yeah, I can do, what I can teaching with my students and when the door is closed with my patients, but there's so much more that we can do to make a difference and to make changes. And so even if this isn't, particularly the psychiatrist's actual area, he or she can do so much by just really speaking out. This one again, you know, you serve on committees, you write letters to the editor, you attend or to accept invitations to give a town hall, you get involved with NAMI, you correct a lot of the misconceptions, you can also speak openly about struggles that you've had in your life, the so-called lived experience. That makes such a difference in reducing stigma. And I think that the repercussions of that then benefit all of citizenry. You know, the benefits extend beyond what we can do with our patients.
Well, that's a lot to do once we've finished up with this podcast. So thank you, Dr. Myers. And thank all of you for listening to Psychiatric Pearls. You can find more of our conversations on the Psychiatric Times website and on iTunes. If you listen to us on iTunes, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us. Thank you so much.